Good morning, everybody. Hope you're doing well. Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain Radio. It is the 4th of May, 2025. And hello. Welcome to your Philosophy Madcap Mayhem on this lovely Sunday morning. And I am like an elephant, all ears, and happy to hear your thoughts, comments, questions, issues, challenges, problems, whatever is on your mind. I certainly have a topic to start with, as I am often wont to do. And that topic, well, I have two topics. The first one is, that's right, freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. freedomain.com/donate. And of course, if you are watching this on Rumble, if you are watching this on Locals, you can donate right in the app, but the least overhead as a whole, although that may be changing. Apple just lost a court case. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Really, really deeply, humbly, gratefully, and thankfully. Because gratefully and thankfully apparently are just two completely different things. I would really humbly, deeply, and gratefully appreciate it. Let's see here. All right, so hit me from a 0 to 10. Give me a 0 to 10. Part 9 of the future, really good stuff. Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. So hit me with a, hey, you just got engaged yesterday. Congratulations. Welcome to Planet Marriage, a lovely place to be. So hit me with a 0 to 10 based on how much drama do you have in your life? And we'll get into the definition of drama right up front, so you know what I'm talking about. So drama is usually composed of three things, right? Number one, it is self-generated. It's not something that comes in externally. It is self-generated. You know, like a woman who's like, would you love me if I was still a worm? That's self-generated, right? That's the number one issue. Number two, of course, it has a negative impact on your life. And number three, it can't be solved. It's not solvable. So how much drama, 0 to 10, how much drama do you have in your life? Because I think that's quite an important question as a whole. You know, there's a, most of you are kind of low, some of you not. 7. Yeah. So remember, it's usually self-inflicted. It has a negative impact on your life and it is not solvable. You can't solve it. So what do we got here? People saying 7, 2, 1, 4, 1, 0, 1. Would the cat be solved? I'd say a 5, 6, 0, 2, 6.5. Oh, that's good. 3, 7, still 2, 1 or 2. Yeah. Okay. 7. Okay. Do toddler tantrums count? I would say not. Although toddler tantrums usually arise because the parents are not listening or modeling good conflict resolution and so on. I mean, people don't believe it when I say, they just don't believe it when I say that my daughter has not ever had a tantrum. She never had a tantrum. Because we would listen and try and facilitate what she wanted. It doesn't mean that we would always give her what she wanted any more than I give myself what I always want. My wife made some absolutely delightful oatmeal raisin cookies yesterday, you know, the thick ones. And I could eat, I limited myself to two small ones. So I have to say, no, to myself. And, you know, of course, if you are saying no to yourself, your kids are more likely to understand the value of that and do all of that. So I guess then the question becomes, how do you solve drama? How do you solve the problem of drama? So the way that I worked with it, I don't really have much left in my life that I can really think of. But yeah, how do you solve drama? Well, I think it's important to recognize when something is self-inflicted versus something that is accidental or just kind of bungeeing in from the outside. So, you know, the question of, would you still love me if I was a worm kind of thing? That's definitely self-inflicted. And there is a general theory, which I think is actually pretty good. Oh, and by the way, we're going to do the first, say, 45 minutes open, and then we're going to go to donor only for the spicier stuff. So if you want to join that in, you can go to fdrurl.com/locals, and you can sign up there for free for a month, or you don't get charged for a month. You can see if you like it, or you can go to subscribestar.com/freedomain and join in from that. So there's a general theory which says the human brain, the human mind, is kind of primed for a certain amount of challenge, difficulty, activity, right? Challenge, difficulty, activity. And if you don't have external challenge and difficulty, you will simply invent it. Your brain is like this Pac-Man looking to solve problems, looking to overcome challenges, looking to maybe have some conflict or win or stretch itself or something like that. So you're either taking on real issues in your life or you're inventing issues, quote issues, right? So for a lot of women are really into leftist political causes, and that has risen fairly in lockstep with not having children, right? A woman is designed to nurture and to be alert and to take care of the underdogs, to take care of the underprivileged, in particular, the youngest of her children, right? This is why from each according to their ability to each according to their needs makes perfect sense to women, because that's how families operate, right? I mean, the father goes out and, you know, would hunt or fight or now go to work. And that's from each according to their ability to each according to their needs means that you transfer resources from the more competent to the less competent through no fault of their own. They're just children, right? And of course, in the hierarchy of siblings, you have older siblings and then you have younger siblings. Now, how children get resources can't be a meritocracy, right? Because then the older children will get a lot of resources and the younger children will not get a lot of resources. So you have to, and sometimes even by force, take resources from the older siblings and give those resources to the younger siblings so the younger siblings have an even chance at health, strength, and survival. So being a mother is sort of foundationally a, quote, leftist cause, but if you can convince women to not have children, then those instincts get transferred to leftist political causes. In other words, if you can convince women that there are certain vulnerable groups in society, certain excluded groups within society, their instincts will be to redistribute resources to those people, right? I mean, that's just, it's a kind of a political biohack, so to speak. So if we have real challenges in our life, you know, we overcome those challenges, we're happy with the work that we've done for the most part, we take on a certain amount of risk and danger and achievement and fight and struggle and all of that. So when we have real issues in our life, we work to overcome them. If we don't have real issues in our life, the tendency is to invent issues that give us the same sense or feeling of achievement. So drama in general comes from not having real issues in your life that you actually have to deal with. All right. Excuse me. So how do you deal with drama? Well, in general, if people are bringing a lot of drama to the table, then you may want to encourage those people to take on real issues, real challenges in their life. And if you do that, then most likely the drama will diminish because you have real things to deal with. So I would certainly say that is a good approach. You can certainly have a rule, and it's a decent rule, it's a good rule, which says, my sympathy for the self-inflicted is minimal. Right? My sympathy for the self-inflicted is minimal. In other words, if somebody has caused their own problems, then listening to them talk about the problems and try and solve their problems, that there's a certain amount of sort of minimal sympathy regarding that. What is the cause of your problem? If the cause of your problem is self-inflicted, you know, if you're a guy and you cheated on your girlfriend, well, that's a self-inflicted problem. If you're someone who has pursued alcohol to the point where you've become an addict or at least a social alcoholic, that's a self-inflicted problem. If somebody's a long-term smoker and they get sick from it, that is a self-inflicted problem. If somebody is obese and has not done the nutritional exercise or self-knowledge work to deal with the source of all of that, then that's self-inflicted. And of course, we can have sympathy for self-inflicted problems, but we do have to, if we want to pursue, you know, the idea of sort of fairness and justice, then we do want to have more sympathy for people who did not cause their own problems. We want to have more sympathy for people who did not cause their own problems. Again, I'm not saying no sympathy, but... And the other thing, too, is that I think it's important to have a tap-out scenario when it comes to talking about people's problems. So if somebody is talking about problems, at some point it's reasonable, maybe a little bit more masculine, but it's reasonable to say, what would constitute a solution? What would you put in the category called solution for this problem? So if somebody's complaining about being overweight, okay, what is the solution? Is the solution to lose weight? Okay, if the solution is to lose weight, and it would seem to me that's the most logical solution, if the solution is to lose weight, then surely... you can then shift from complaining about being overweight to, you know, maybe talking about the challenges of losing weight. So I think that's the best way to make sure that your productive energies are aligned with things that are not less self-inflicted. So sympathy for people who, you know, maybe they get sick out of nowhere, or you know, they're having challenges because some company bought out their company and laid everyone off, like things that they didn't necessarily cause themselves, and have some sympathy for that. And yeah, not self-inflicted, has a negative impact on your life for sure. And is there a solution? Because I mean, you can piss years of your life away listening to people complain about things they inflicted on themselves that has a negative impact on you, for which there is no particular solution. Somebody says, there's a good joke on that. A man complaining in the bar about how his girlfriend dumped him. Friend says, of course she dumped you. You said you were going out for flowers, and instead you went golfing. Man, talk about not seeing the florist for the teas. It's raining dats and cogs. All right, so let me get to your... So that's my... 14 minutes on on drama. All right. Let's see here. Somebody says, So I hope I'm concise yet detailed enough. I have a recording of my district manager going off at me in a verbally abusive way. I wasn't in the wrong on anything, and my store manager thankfully talked to me and calmed me down over the situation. Is it wise to give the recording to HR? I don't know. I can't tell you what to do. There's a complex situation. What I would do if I were in your shoes is I would sit down and go through the employee manual. I'm sure that HR has policies on workplace bullying and so on. And maybe sit down with HR, not necessarily give them the recording, but sit down with them and say, what is your policy on workplace bullying and so on? And then say, you know, what would you do if you saw workplace bullying? And maybe you could quote a little bit and say, would this count? Like, don't play the recording necessarily, but sort of feel out what their response is. Like, would it, if someone said X, Y, Z, would that count as workplace bullying? And what would the remedy be? What would happen? Right. So to try and sort of figure out what dominoes you're setting in motion first. HR. All right. Hit me with a why. I haven't watched you since, well, last I remember you were playing Doom Eternal on YouTube, I think. Well, I'm subscribed to you now. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And thank you for the tip. freedomain.com/donate. I would appreciate that. Okay. So if, I mean, I worked in HR. I've worked in HR before. Hit me with a why. If you have ever found HR to be helpful and good at sorting out problems. I have not. And my entire goal as an entrepreneur was to be in a small enough company that we didn't need an HR department. Bum, 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 ba-da-bum, bum, bum, bum. All right. Let's see, what do people say here? A steady no. A steady set of no's. My workplace has a zero tolerance policy clearly spelled out about harassment. Okay. Zero tolerance with what result? With what result? Oh, somebody says yes, although I haven't had many issues. Okay. Good. Good to know. All right. All right. So, I would sort of feel out because sometimes, you know, it's like the problem with going to the principal if a kid is being bullied at school, right? It could make things worse. All right. So somebody writes, my question is on how to and when to talk to your kids about the death of a friend. My daughter is 9 years old and became friends with an older lady at church. This older lady passed away this past winter, when we were not attending church because of sicknesses going around. Now we are moving, and my kids want to go to say goodbye to all their friends at church. But if they go to say goodbye, then we will need to tell our kids about the death of her friend. Do we tell her or just leave? Oh, I say, or just like leave the environment? So nine. Yeah, I think, I mean, personally think that nine is old enough. So, you know, kids see the world, right? Kids see the world. So kids see that there are babies, and kids see that there are toddlers and children and teenagers and young adults and middle-aged adults and elderly adults. So they see the whole span, right? I mean, they don't necessarily understand the process by which things go, but they recognize, of course, that there are older people. So you could say something like, why do you think, you know, people keep getting born and yet the world is not, you know, stacked nine people deep, right? And that's because people die. Now, they may have seen graveyards and so on, right? So yes, we are born, we have many decades of, you know, good health and energy and so on, and then we get really old, and then our bodies wear out and we die, and dying is like going to sleep without dreaming forever and ever. It's not a painful situation. And it's kind of what Socrates said about death. He said, look, either death is I have an afterlife where I get to speak to the greatest minds, poets, philosophers, and thinkers the world has ever seen, which would be a wonderful thing. Or, you know, my best night's sleep was a night where I slept without dreaming. I didn't, you know, have wild dreams and wake up and, right? So when I would go to sleep, I would always want a night without dreaming, so I could get a really solid night's sleep. So if death is like an eternal night, like sleeping without dreaming, that's not bad. I will not suffer any more after I die than I did before I was born. I will not be here. Or as Ayn Rand somewhat selfishly said, it is not I who will end to the world, but the world that will end to me. It's not quite true, but we can understand why she might think that. So yeah, I think that, people are born in part because people die. And it's how we have all of this wonderful language, and you can talk about evolution, and, you know, every kid's a little bit different and in general a little bit more advanced than their parents. And this is why we have all of these great brains, and we have all of this lovely technology, and we have, you know, all of these, this great literature and music and all of that, because kids are born to replace their parents. I was born to replace my parents, who, you know, are very old. You are born to replace me. And life is a very long process. It is a very long process. It's a very long process. Some people say life is short. Maybe it's short if you just do the same thing every day, but I don't. I find life to be just right. I mean, at 59 this year, that's right. I mean, that it feels exactly right. It feels exactly right. Just long enough. I mean, I've done a lot of different things in my life, successes and failures and strivings and all of that. I've been up, I've been down, sideways, and it's good. It's good. Life is just right. Life is just right. So, and you know, of course, you want to tell your kids that the length of your life has a lot to do with the choices you make, right? Don't get overweight. Don't smoke, don't drink too much alcohol, exercise, and, you know, get your checkups and get your blood work and blah, blah, blah. Not medical advice or anything, it's just stuff that I've heard of and stuff that I do. So I would say that, I think 9, yeah. It's going to be a little bit of a shock, for sure, for kids. And, yeah, I remember my daughter when she was very little saying, so dying is when you just, like, you fall asleep, but then you wake up, right? I don't know. Well, I said nobody knows for sure, and nobody does know for sure what happens after death. I don't believe anything happens after death. I think I am a storm of electrical and biochemical energy that is somewhat self-willed, and I think that when you turn that radio off, the voices don't go to some magical place, but nobody knows for sure. So, yeah, I think, you have to judge. I can't tell you this for sure. But I think at 9, it depends on how many kids you have, of course, because the 9-year-old might then start talking to the younger kids. And I would say, you know, this is kind of a conversation for older kids. So don't flow this down to the younger kids, because you need to have a certain age to be able to sort of process this. I mean, they're going to have to learn about death. And certainly I would say, you know, prior to puberty, right? Because puberty is the biggest change we go through as people outside of death, or birth, I suppose. It's a bit tendentious. But, we go through puberty. Why? What's happening? Well, your body is getting ready to go down the path of having babies. Well, why? Babies. Why about babies? Well, You know how when my car died, I got a new car kind of thing, right? Things wear out, you need to replace them. It's true in life. There's entropy, right? Things wear out and you need to replace them. It's the same thing with people. And of course, if they've had pets, then they may have gone through that as well, right? Everyone, every kid has that moment, right? I had hamsters and mice. And I still remember breeding the hamsters, and then I thought that the mother was eating her babies. It was horrifying. I thought the mother hamster was eating her babies. I remember this in the bathroom in the flat we lived in England. But she was just storing them in her cheeks for safety. I was like, don't eat your babies. All right. Don't be my mother. Ooh. Ooh. little dark sewage tunnel there. All right. I strongly disagree with corrupting sugar and raisins with oatmeal. How dare you? I'm a big fan of roughage. Regular bowel movements are a glorious thing. And doesn't oatmeal, isn't it roughage? Anyway. Do, 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 do. All right. Let's see here. Losing years listening to people complain about things they inflicted on themselves. Some screwing up with my family of origin. I'm sorry to hear that. All right. Yeah, women, again, this is a big generalization. Women are better at preventing problems than solving problems. Because women are all about keeping toddlers safe. They prevent problems, right? All right. Let's see here. What do we got? Have you been observing Alberta since the federal election results came in? They have a petition circulating to have a vote to break off from Canada. Their premier lowered the limit needed to get a vote to leave. I don't know if they will break away from Canada, but there are big moves being made. I'm interested in your thoughts on the subject again. Thanks again. Great show. I mean, it's kind of political, Anne, but you know, Canada was formed significantly through bribery. And just look at how much money the federal government pumped at Newfoundland to get them to join Canada and so on. So even if they get the petition, and even if there's sort of a movement towards that, I think a combination of threats and bribery will probably scotch that. All right. Maybe the most difficult thing was being in the room with my niece when she was 4 and telling her granddad passed away. Heartbreaking. He was only 57. Died of a heart attack at work. Yeah, 4 is tough, man. 4 is tough. On the topic of death, I have been reading up on near-death experiences lately and how there is documented cases of people having experiences that imply there could be an afterlife. What are your thoughts, and have you ever read up on the topic? I've read certainly some, say documented, like what? What do you mean documented? People have just reported it. You know, like I was dying, there was a bright light, I saw relatives, I felt like I was rising, I could see my body above myself, I felt like I was floating through. Okay, these are subjective experiences that can't be documented. It's like saying Lord of the Rings is documented because it's written down. It doesn't mean it's true. It's fiction, right? So if they, you know, people sort of, they quote die and then they come back. So they didn't die, because to die is to stay dead. To stay dead, right? So I do think that people would probably go through similar experiences as their brains are shutting down, which would probably be quite vivid. You know, people say I had a flashback or bright lights or relatives or whatever it is. And, you know, I was haunted for some time by when I was doing research for my first novel called The Jealous War, about World War One. I did a lot of research on the experiences of soldiers. And there were a lot of soldiers who, when they were dying, were crying out for their mothers. And I think George Floyd was reported to be doing that, but some people say that Mama was the nickname of his girlfriend. So when they were dying, were they hallucinating that their mothers were taking care of them? Were they trying to get the attention of hallucinated mothers? Or were they just going back to a very primal state and looking for probably the most secure and safe bond they had? So I think that there's a common experience that people go through as they're dying. And if they are revived, I assume that what they say has a certain amount of similarity to it. It's kind of tough to say because, of course, people hear a lot of the same kind of stories about dying. So maybe that influences the experiences that they go through. But if there would be you'd need some kind of proof of an afterlife. And the proof of an afterlife would be, you know, kind of a Ouija board style or a seance or something, right? So I would say that if you could get information from somebody after they died that only that person would know, that would be an indication of an afterlife. So if there's an afterlife where people kind of peel off and go places and there's no returning, then that's the same as there not being an afterlife, so to speak, right? So there would be various proofs for an afterlife. I don't know that subjective experiences that are reported upon where there's a common theme to people's experiences, which could have come from them reading other things that other people experienced when they were dying or going through that process. So, you know, the rigor of proof would have to be quite a bit. So if, you know, if we had an eternal soul, we would imagine that it would be around before we were born, but we don't have any memories from before we were born. And there's no information that is available to us from people who've died that only they would know. That would be proof that they were communicating with us. So to me, if you sort of look at it in terms of like rigorous scientific experiment, I don't think there's enough to pass it. Now, it's a lovely idea. I mean, the idea that I would spend eternity with my wife and get to sit down and vibe with Socrates and Aristotle and Ayn Rand and like whatever, right? I mean, that's a absolutely beautiful thought. Absolutely beautiful thought. But of course, I mean, in the afterlife, a world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun, day or night. I wouldn't even know who I would be in the afterlife. Like, I wouldn't know how I would function, how, because, you know, my days are sort of organized around love and productivity and helping people and generosity and virtue, you know, as best as I can achieve. So my days are kind of organized around that. You wouldn't have a principle by which to organize your days in paradise or in an afterlife. You wouldn't need to eat. I assume there wouldn't be any sexual activity because you'd be in bliss anyway. You wouldn't have any principle by which to organize your day. There would be no shortages. There would be no limitations. And you would have an eternity. Now, of course, my consciousness, and I think this is true for everyone's consciousness, my consciousness is processed or founded by a scarcity. My hours are scarce, my life is scarce, my time is scarce, my energy is not infinite, and so on, right? What's that? Somebody chillingly wrote and said, aging is one day you just wake up tired and stay that way forever. Nothing yet so far, but. So I would say that I wouldn't know who I would be in an afterlife. I wouldn't need to work out. I wouldn't need to diet. I wouldn't need to do any stretches. I wouldn't need to sleep. I don't know what my consciousness would do with eternal happiness and an absence of scarcity, because the pursuit of happiness and the recognition of scarcity is what sort of drives all of our consciousnesses. So the I in the afterlife is hard to conceive of, right? It would be such a different mindset as a whole. So, who are your favorite science fiction authors? Looking for good fiction books for when my kids become teenagers. Oh, let's see. Who did I like? Arthur C. Clarke when I was younger. The 6 Billion Names of God is a great story. It's a great story, short story collection. Childhood's End was really kind of freaky. 2001 was okay. Bit of a drug trip. I used to like Ray Bradbury quite a bit. I read a lot of his stories, and then I realized that he was just another subversive, right? He was just somebody else who was dismantling the West as a whole. And so I remember reading, he wrote a book of short stories that came out when I was in my early 20s. I think it was after his whole The Cinnamon Winds of Mars stuff. But I found them just terrible, and I never really read him after that. And then sort of thinking back and looking back on him later in life, it was like, oh yeah, it's just another subversive who was sort of corrupting the young. So let's see, who else did I read science fiction? I never got into Isaac Asimov. I found him too dry. And his son was a real creep. Oh my God. Like turbo creep. Which it's pretty hard to respect for me. What else? Who else did I read? Science fiction style. Study War No More. Was that Joe Haldeman? There was a good story about that. Pretty grim, about enforced empathy. Yeah, sorry, it's been too long. I haven't really read science fiction since. Alan Dean Foster. I thought he would. He wrote actually pretty solid. He wrote adaptations of movies. So when I was really into a movie, I would read the adaptation. Alan Dean Foster wrote a bunch of those. There was an adaptation of the movie Superman that was written that was really kind of incomprehensible. I remember it had a hydrogen sail spaceship, and it was all just kind of crazy. And there was also one that was for Close Encounters of the Third Kind that was at Stevie Wonder's Moog device and all this kind of community. So, yeah, it's been a long time. Michael Crichton, I think I read, I read Jurassic Park. It was it was okay. I guess that's science fiction, but not futuristic science fiction. But kids become teenagers. Yeah, I was reading a lot of fantasy in my early teens, for sure. All right. Somebody says, I went on a date yesterday with a lovely woman. I'll do another couple of minutes and we'll go. Dan Donnerly. However, in our conversations, I think you mean she revealed how she suffered a lot of evil and experienced a lot of trauma, as I suspected. If she were a call-in, she'd probably be the worst we've heard. I tried being supportive, valuable, and helpful. The whole situation has my head spinning. I know I'm not going to date her, in part due to the fact that she's 9 years older than me. I'm 29, she's 38. I'm curious what you would do in this situation, Steph. I'm not a religious person, but I felt the urge to pray. I'm at such a loss. The questions and advice I gave, so far, didn't seem to make an impact. Also, she didn't seem to like the fact I pushed back on her belief she came from a good family. Well, I want you to think of being a coach. Like you're a gymnastics coach or whatever, right? And, you know, every now and then, you're going to come across people who clearly would be good at gymnastics, right? They're very flexible, they're very rapid-fire responses, they're very athletic and so on. And it's a little different. Let's skip from gymnastics to, say, boxing, right? Because gymnastics, you have to start pretty young. So let's say that you are a boxing coach, and every now and then, you come across people who have insanely fast reflexes. They've got a very big build, a very solid build, and you know they have a certain amount of feral aggression. Maybe you see them at the arcade or something, and they're incredibly fast, or maybe they hit really that boxing thing really hard, or whatever it is, right? And you have this thought, wow, that person would be an amazing boxer, right? Let's say they're, I don't know, 18 or whatever, incredibly fast and strong. And, you know, you've got a sense of these things, right? Well, of course, you can go to them and say, hey, have you ever thought about being a boxer? And if they're like, oh, man, I've been thinking for years about being a boxer. I just don't know how to start. I'm dying for it. You know, I skip rope. I catch oranges while jogging down the street. I do all these kinds of things, right? I got Bill Conti in my ears 24/7. I love to be. Okay, well, then you can invite them down to the gym. You can give them some tryouts and see what their skills are, or whatever natural abilities, I guess, more than skills, right? So if you're a good coach, good boxing coach, then you're going to every now and then come across people who would be good boxers, and you can approach them and see if they're interested in being boxers, right? However, if they're like, oh, no, boxing is for idiots. I don't want to break my brain. And, you know, you couldn't pay me enough money to be a boxer in this or any other lifetime or universe, right? Okay, well, what are you going to do? They don't want to be a boxer. Now, I guess you could say, no, boxing is a noble, blah, 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 whatever, right? You could make a bit of a case. But if they're just like, no, I don't want to, how would I want to be a boxer? Boxing is stupid, whatever, right? Okay, so what do you do? You have to move on. Even though they may have skills, even though they may have potential, they don't want to be a boxer. Okay. I mean, I have this continually. I mean, I think I'm a fairly good coach and in philosophy and self-knowledge and virtue, hopefully. So I come across people who seem to have a lot of potential, and I'll talk a little bit about philosophy. And if they just, philosophy is bullshit, whatever, right? Okay. So you just got to move on, right? If people don't want what you have to offer, I mean, you can make a sales pitch. People don't want what you have to offer. You know, if you say, well, you know, if you had this amount of trauma as a child, maybe your family wasn't as great. She's like, no, my family's great. It's great. Okay. Don't want to be a boxer. I mean, you have to respect their decision and let them accrue their consequences. If this is where she's at when she's pushing 40, that's where she's at. What can you do? You just have to have, you know, I hate to sort of say you have to have the strength and moral fiber, because of course that sounds like begging the question, but you have to be strict with yourself regarding people who don't want what you have to offer. Right? It may be incomprehensible to you, right? It may be incomprehensible to you, but she's pushing 40. She's single. So kids are off the table. I mean, let's be realistic. Oh, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, okay, whatever. People who don't save their money occasionally win the lottery and they can retire on that. But that's not any kind of plan. She's 38. Has still a lot of unprocessed trauma and is single. She's not having kids. She's not having kids. She's not having kids. So, if she were to change now and realize that there was unprocessed trauma she should have dealt with, maybe the conversations with her parents that I continually recommend, right? If she were to start going through that whole process, it's going to take her years. She's going to be in her 40s. And maybe at the end of that process, she's sort of Angela Belka Marino style. She's like, I'm 43. I have baby fever. It's like, well, and I want to be a rocket, right? So recognize the cost later on in life when people change. If you're selling change to someone who's pushing 40, you're basically saying to them, you've wasted 20 years and you've lost the chance to have children. And because you've lost the chance to have children, you have boxed yourself out of the reach of a lot of the most high quality men, because high quality men want to have kids. They want to pass along their benefits. They want to have people to live for, and they want to raise children, and they want to pass along their wisdom and so on. So you at 29, you've been going through this process of change for some years. So you've prevented a lot of problems. What would it cost her to truly grow? Probably too much. All right. How's Brexit working these days? Yes, bit of a wasted effort. I mean, probably worth a shot, but did not. Somebody says, we are taught life is a three-act story. Premortal existence. Excuse me. When we sided with Heavenly Father and chose to come to this world, we have this life to exercise agency to grow and learn. Then there is a spirit world in 2B parts, paradise or prison. then will come resurrection and judgment. We can work to help the dead if they choose it. Helps to know there is much we can do. Okay. Oh, this is regarding the kid. My husband just wants us to go away and protect her because he dealt with the death of his brother and grandfather's young and wants our kids not to deal with this. And the daughter who has this friend also lost her cat a couple of years ago, so she has a hard time with death. Yeah, but of course, I mean, she's probably too young if this is the four-year-old, but death is one of these Aristotelian mean things. You don't want to over-focus on it because then you feel life could be meaningless. You don't want to unfocus on it because then you waste time, right? So you got to keep death at a middle distance from yourself. Do you have any thoughts on Jehovah's Witnesses? A business partner I have is considering leaving their church but lacks the courage. Jehovah's Witnesses are forbidden from speaking with former members. That's a good question, and why don't we, at the moment, go local supporters? So, I'm going to stop the show here for the public donors, for public people, and of course, freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. I would appreciate it. Actually, I've not received any donations over the course of this show. I'll put that on me. Maybe I'm not being fascinating enough, but if you could help out, I would really appreciate it. freedomain.com/donate. And if you want to join the local supporters, you can go to fdrurl.com/locals and sign up there. And we will go over there and I will stop the show here for the public people, the non-supporters, and we'll get nice and juicy and spicy on the donor side, which will only be released to donors. So, of course, thank you very much for your support of the show. We'll talk to you in a sec. freedomain.com/donate. Thanks.